Greetings, this is James Gillen, and I'm your host. We've got another great show. We've got Courtney Brown, and he's a mathematician and social scientist who teaches in the Department of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He's independent of his work at the university. He's also the leading scholar on the subject of remote viewing, as is done through using procedures that were developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes, or procedures that are derivative to those methodologies. Dr. Brown is the director and founder of the Farsight Institute, a nonprofit research and education organization dedicated to the study of a phenomenon of non-local consciousness known as remote viewing. He recently published a book on the subject, Remote Viewing, the Science and Theory of Non-Physical Perception, and it's the only book of its kind where the science of remote viewing is developed with respect to highly structured data collection methodologies. In this book, he analyzes the data and develops a new theory that explains the remote viewing phenomenon as a consequence of superposition formation on the quantum level. And without any further ado, we want to bring Courtney on the air. Are you with us?
Yes, James, I am here, and I want to thank you for inviting me on your show. It's an honor.
Is it all right to call you Courtney, or should I call you Dr. Brown?
Absolutely. No, I even have my undergraduates at the university call me Courtney. That's what I prefer.
Yeah, that's the way I like it too. I don't even give my last name. I said, just call me James.
You know? I don't like any sort of honorifics or anything in front of it. In fact, my nieces and nephews, which I have numerous, I like them not to use the word uncle, just to call me Court, just like a regular person. That way, it doesn't set me apart from anybody.
Yeah, we have a pretty educated listening audience, and they're very familiar with remote viewing and some of the other logistics about that, but for the ones that are just coming in, maybe you can give us a quick synopsis on just what remote viewing is.
Sure.
And some of the techniques that you use
Sure. Well, the remote viewing is a mental procedure, and it is used to transfer information across time and space from the past to the present, from the future to the present, from the present to the present, but any place, any time. The procedures of which I am the leading scholar, the leading academic anywhere, in studying the procedures that were developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes, or procedures that are derivative of those methodologies. I am unambiguously, and this is not boasting, I'll explain why, I am the leading academic anywhere to study remote viewing as it is performed using those methodologies, because I am the only one. And I like to say that to poke fun at my academic colleagues, sort of teasing them that it's ridiculous that I should be the only one studying the phenomenon of remote viewing using these structured data collection military derived procedures. But that is the way it is. And I'm also the director of the Farsight Institute. That's FARSIGHT, like seeing far, .org, because we're a nonprofit. And we're the biggest science shop that exists. And basically, as a summary of what it does, a person under totally blind conditions, using these military or military-derived procedures, goes into a room, meaning they're not told anything about anything. They're just given an email saying, there's a target, view it. They go in with a stack of paper and a pen, into a room, and they sit down, and an hour to an hour and a half later, they come out with 10 to 20 pages of detailed, absolutely unambiguous data describing that thing that's supposed to be their focus of perception that we call a target. The target can be any place, any event, people, whatever, and that target is determined by someone called a tasker who never has any contact with the remote viewer prior to them doing the sessions and so on. And we are the leading and really the only science shop that exists anywhere. We're a scientific and research institute. And I work with people like Lynn Buchanan, who came out of Defense Intelligence Agency. He's the leading trainer in controlled remote viewing. And that has an intellectual heritage that is tied back to Ingo Swann. And I also work with Glenn Wheaton, for example, and he runs the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild. And Glenn Wheaton came out of Special Forces Intelligence in what was actually a unofficial movement within the military that later became known as the 1st Earth Battalion that was the focus of the movie Men Who Stare at Goats, and that was starring George Clooney and Jeff Bridges. That's a recent movie. And so this is the type of thing that I do and the type of people I work with, in the sense that I work with their students. And so I work with civilian second and third generation remote viewers, and the military guys are the ones who's really started that, and they did a lot of all the training. But I work with these civilian second generation people. These are the best remote viewers on the planet. The ones I work with, there's fewer than 20. They are have dedicated typically over 10 years to master these procedures. And it's like playing the piano. Anyone can bang on the piano, but to do these procedures correctly and to get them to a fine art, it's like Lang Lang playing the piano in Carnegie Hall. If you want to bang on the piano, that's one thing, but if you want to play with Lang Lang in Carnegie Hall, you got to study for 10 plus years to make your piano playing really great. And that's what these people are, in an analogous way to remote viewing. And I work with those people in doing these studies that we do that are really high-end interesting in terms of what we look at.
Yeah, I've got about 10 envelopes I'd like to send you, but maybe we can, I'm sure you've probably opened up those envelopes already, and maybe we can cover that on the show. I know your website just has so much information, and you were saying you had a DVD that people could get that would kind of simplify things and condense things so they can have a greater understanding.
That's been a problem. We have so much on the website that people have, of late, the last few years, saying, you know, where do I start? It's overwhelming. So, unusually for us, we came out with a DVD, and this DVD is really good. It's called The Farsight Experiments. Farsight is one word. The Farsight Experiments. And it's sold through Amazon, but we have links to it directly on our website, which is farsight.org. And the DVD summarizes the major projects that we've done over the last 5 years. And which are, I'll just summarize them. One is called the Multiple Universes Project, and that was an actual test to see if the existence of parallel realities actually worked. We had a fascinating experimental design that was very unusual, never done before, and that results, the actual experiment, the data, and the results actually were published in a leading peer-reviewed scientific journal, the Journal of Scientific Exploration, and a free copy of the article that just came out a few months ago can be found on our website. If you go to the homepage at www.farsight.org, underneath the picture of the DVD, you'll also see a banner saying Latest Peer-Reviewed Published Research, Remote Viewing the Future. And if you click on that, you'll see a copy of that. And so that was a real milestone, because that was the first major published research using second generation civilian remote viewers that ever happened. And it was real interesting, because we were testing for the existence of multiple realities, parallel realities. And that was interesting. James, let me ask you, what color shirt are you wearing today?
Oh, it's kind of a fuchsia, actually.
Okay. Well, there is another version of us in which you're wearing a red shirt, and another one where you're wearing a blue shirt, and it goes on. And so, and another one where you're interviewing somebody else rather than me. And so what we did was we actually tested to see if these multiple realities actually exist, and that's on the DVD. Also on the DVD, we have a project that was an anomaly on Mars, which was a horizontal spray that was coming out of a metal, that was coming out of a nozzle connected to a pipeline going into a dome. And there were some other domes nearby. And we did a remote viewing project under totally squeaky clean scientific conditions, totally blind, of what that was. The remote viewers went in, replicated the high resolution data that was available with the NASA JPL Malin Space Science Systems photograph of that anomaly. And then they also saw the domes, and they went into the domes. So we have a high-tech inhabited facility on Mars, and this is not a vague thing like there's bases on Mars. This is a thing where we say that's it exactly. That's the high resolution NASA photograph of it. That's the picture of it, and this is the remote viewing data saying what's in it and replicating everything on the surface, but also going in. And then we also did another project of a planet that exploded between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Some people like to call that planet Maldek. But that planet actually did exist, and the planetary data for that is exceptionally strong, and it was developed and summarized by Thomas Van Flandern, who is the late astronomer, mainstream astronomer, who was the head of his Department of Celestial Mechanics at the Naval Observatory, very mainstream. But that particular set of data that he collected was widely scoffed at by mainstream astronomers who don't like to think that the planets could explode for whatever reason, even though the data are really quite unambiguous. We did a test of that called the Exploding Planet Project, and in fact, Thomas Van Flandern was 100% correct, is 100% correct, and there was a planet, and it exploded right in our own solar system for reasons I have ideas about, but that's another project. Anyway, and then we also did something that people are really talking about now, and that's a project that involves the post-2012, like a beginning of, from now, between now and June 1st, 2013, Earth changes. Now, that was supposed to be a project that was to detect mild climatic differences. I was not someone who was sold on this Mayan calendar stuff, but I've eaten my words since then. We were expecting mild climatic differences, and what we found between June 1st, 2008 and June 1st, 2013 was humongous Earth changes, and that's on the DVD as well. So you get the idea. We have lots of projects. All the science is explained and packed onto that DVD. It makes it easier for people to hit the ground running and get an idea of what we do.
Now, that planet that exploded, that would be the asteroid belt, the remnants of that planet.
That was created. That created the asteroid belt.
Yeah, and the I always felt that we have this reoccurring pattern here. It happened in Atlantis and Lemuria or Mu, and of technology just kind of running amok, and the guys who are self-serving and want to do the power over other program, misusing technology. That we keep running this same pattern over and over again, and that was an extreme example where they ended up blowing up their own planet.
that was very interesting. We actually know the date when that happened. It happened 3 million years ago, which was not long. Uh-huh. And although the Mars Anomaly Project does not go into other stuff that I know about that planet, because of each project does its own thing, but the other data have been collected with regard to this, but I haven't yet gotten to all of that, suggesting that planet was inhabited. We know that it was potentially warm and inhabitable because there are many comets that are newly entering our solar system for the first time, and they have 3 million year elliptical orbits. That means they were ejected from the solar system 3 million years ago, and they're coming back in for the first time. And they have salt in the water that's on them. That tells you that they came from a place where there was salt water. And so this is summarizing stuff, some very basic stuff that Thomas Van Flandern outlined. But the basic idea is it happened 3 million years ago. It was apparently extremely close to Mars, which is why half of Mars is heavily cratered, and the other half of Mars has almost no craters on it. The cratered side of Mars is also thicker. The crust is thicker than the uncratered side. So whatever hit, whatever exploded near Mars, and it basically was a bad day for Mars. Yeah. Interestingly, it did not destroy all life on Mars. It probably wrecked everything up, but we do know this because the evidence of a surface nuclear explosion in the Mare-Acidelium region of Mars is overwhelming in terms of radioisotope data. Mm-hmm. So there was apparently a surface nuclear explosion on the surface of Mars, and that happened 1 million years ago. Mm-hmm. So whatever happened 3 million years ago was a bad day for Mars, but it unbelievably didn't extinguish all life on that planet. The ending of civilized type of life on that planet really finished with the nuclear explosion in the Mare-Acidelium region, which blew off the rest of the atmosphere. And then we have Mars as we see it today. But we do have that anomaly on Mars. So we do know that there are bases, and we know exactly where they are, well, especially that one, plus really good data on that. So that is an example of civilizations, us, you know, not doing so well, and this idea of a polarized existence, fighting among themselves, that is very much us. And it's very reasonable to assume that all those people that were involved on those two planets are on Earth now, in the sense of, you know, where else are they going to be born? They're both born most likely in the same solar system. And we are, in a sense, replaying some of that drama now, which is exactly what you were saying, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same scenario. It's, you know, I guess Atlantis, Casey called it the Law of One and the Sons of Belial.
And, actually, it's an interesting thing because we have a project that we just completed the remote viewing on, but I'm working on the video for it now, and that dealt with the Atlantis thing because we have really, really good Google Earth data on ruins under the water and under the ocean floor in various places. And we did a remote viewing a project using those anomalous things on the bottom of the ocean, and we in fact do know the whole story that there, and that will be formally released in a few months. But the basic idea is that there was a civilization, not extraterrestrial, it was us.
Yeah.
And we existed about, it destroyed itself through science gone bad 70,000 years ago. And mainstream scientists call this event the Toba incident. They think that a volcano popped up, but a volcano doesn't poke a hole in the crust of the Earth the size of Australia, and that's basically what happened.
Yeah.
And what happened was it was an energy device that they were meddling with, and it was a clean energy device, but they were doing something different with it, and it didn't blow up all of a sudden. They actually had a chance to see it, like this, like the meters were going off the scale. You wouldn't believe the remote viewing sessions are so detailed. The meters were going off the scale, and they had enough time, some days, to alert the rest of the planet. This was a potentially extinction-level event. And they were trying to get fecund women or child-bearing age women onto boats, hopefully to be able to save some. They actually did manage to save 2,000 breeding people. And we know that because the geneticists have determined that without ambiguity. 70,000 years ago, whatever the event was, killed off everybody on the planet except for 2,000 breeding people. And we are all descended from those exact same 2,000 people. And that is not in dispute in the scientific literature. The only thing is in dispute is what actually caused it. It was not a volcano. It was us. We had technology and we blew ourselves up with it. So, you know, hopefully we're going to do a little better this time around. But we've had our issues in the past.
Gain a little wisdom from that experience. It seems like this is an ongoing event, not just here on Earth, but in other civilizations as well, and some of them, some of which colonize Earth. They have this program of developing these amazing civilizations that get polarized, and one group splits off and wants to use the science to control and power over others, and then they do the whole place in, and then they have to start over again.
Yeah, this is actually a project that I'm working on, actually, the idea of this, of where we came from. There's two issues associated with it, which is first, what planet we came from, or what area we came from. And that clearly, the evidence clearly suggests if, the, you know, I was at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and in Boulder, Colorado this summer, I gave a presentation at the Society for Scientific Exploration where I explained why remote viewing works, how it works. And actually on our website, we have a recording of it. A video recording was made, a really good one, called Remote Viewing and Quantum Science. It's on our homepage in an embedded video, actually on the homepage. So if you just go to farsight.org, you can see that presentation in Boulder. And there's where I talk about the reason remote viewing actually can work, because we're transferring information across time and space in total violation of what the presumed laws of physics are. So I explain what actually has to be done. But a corollary to that is an explanation that fits in with that of how space travel actually works. And, for example, UFOs don't use rocket propulsion systems. So I explain basically the type of transportation or the type of travel that's actually possible. And there's two types. The first I called horizontal space travel, and that's travel between, say, Earth and Mars, the Mars you see right now and the Earth that you see right now. But I also talk about the frequency basis of existence and how that fits in with the electromagnetic spectrum. The idea is that physicists have never, ever found anything solid. No billiard ball solid particles exist. Everything is energy, everything is frequency. And if you look at your couch or your computer or your house, it may look solid, but no physicist has ever found anything solid. They only find energy, and energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. C squared is just a constant, so it's a scaling factor, so energy equals mass. And so the basic idea is everything is energy, so we have to interpret reality as how energy interacts with one another. We don't have time to get into it today, but the result is that if everything is frequencies interacting, what mainstream scientists have assumed, they have implied, although they have not explicitly stated this because they don't fully grasp it, but they have implied that the only energy that we really interact with places us essentially in the middle of the visible spectrum of the visible light spectrum, uh-huh. of the visible light band of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is that frequencies, when they interact, they really only interact well to produce a result, like what scientists would call a superposition, a state of superposition in the creation of a wave packet. They only really interact well if the frequencies are relatively close together, meaning the uh-huh. waves and the peaks and the trough are relatively similar. For example, if you go up to your keyboard on your piano and you hit middle C, and then you also hit B, you'll hear the beat frequency that results as a result of the what the scientists would call constructive and destructive interference processes. And that beat frequency will sound like a warble, wah, 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 wah. Hit middle C and then hit the highest B on the keyboard. You won't hear that. There still is interference between the two waves, but it's so minor you can't really, it's nothing to write home about. When the frequencies near, they interact and they affect each other in noticeable ways. So if we are made up of energy, you and me, James, are made up of energy, and our houses are made up of energy, and the buildings, and then the earth, and the universe, so on, the things that we can see and interact with are things that are going to be waves that are near us, frequencies that are near. So we're really basically, you might say our quantum signature, the average frequency for all that we have that makes us up, is sort of in the middle of the visible light band of this of the electromagnetic spectrum. Physicists have basically implied, although they have not explicitly stated this because they haven't thought this through, but they've implied that the aggregations of things that can assemble through frequencies, I call them superposition ensembles, but the aggregations such as you, me, planets, cannot happen elsewhere in the electromagnetic spectrum at higher frequencies. For example, that wouldn't happen in the X-ray band or the gamma ray band. So they assume that those areas basically are just X-rays and gamma rays, which are high-frequency light, but nothing else. But I say there's absolutely no reason to assume that whatsoever. In those higher-frequency realms, you have frequencies that are, the waves are tighter packed together, so you might call those higher densities. And so what you have, and at those higher densities, you could also have superposition aggregations, or what I call superposition ensembles, which means planets, civilizations, other things. We would not see them. They would be out of sync from us. And so you have what I call vertical space travel. So everything that exists has to go through horizontal space travel, moving from place to place, and vertical space travel. And that's what you see when you see UFOs that are using technology that exploit that. You see them in the sky, and then suddenly you don't see them. They're off the radar screen. You can't see them anymore. And then they pop up somewhere else. Well, they become essentially invisible by changing their frequencies center. And thus, they become out of sync with us. And that's what vertical space travel is all about. And so when we talk about where we came from, you have to ask, well, horizontally, where did we come from? And vertically. What I think happened is that beings elsewhere came to Earth, and that meant they had to travel vertically as well as horizontally. And when they got here, they weren't really compatible with the electromagnetic setup of the planet. And so that they had to get life, they had to, if they were going to live here, they had to have body vehicles that would be compatible with the gravity and the electromagnetic setup for the planet. And they took genetics from naturally evolving species, apes, things like that, reptiles, others, that were already here, and they spliced that into their own DNA, and here we mainstream people, scientists say that humans in anatomically correct manner appeared 200,000 years ago. But, you know, you can't pop a human out of an ape in that record time. You need hundreds of millions of slow evolution to pop a human out of an ape. I'm not saying that Darwinian evolution can happen, but you can't have us do what we did in the length of times, in the short bursts of times that exist. And you can't have, and what happened is we not only popped up here, but we also popped a civilization, a major civilization out very quickly, and that was destroyed only 70,000 years ago. All this stuff can't happen so quickly in natural evolutionary states. So I'm not saying Darwinian evolution can't happen, but what we do see historically happening on Earth suggests that we're a product of genetic engineering. Mm-hmm.
I've always believed in creative evolution, and along with some tinkering from a few off-world visitors that were here.
Perhaps quite a few.
Yeah, yeah. The you know, it's interesting. The I love how you explained the electromagnetic light spectrum as actually being dimensions and possibly civilizations on those dimensions. We did something here where we took a huge infrared spotlight, and then we took third generation night vision, you know, the military kind. They yeah. seem to make the best. And we light up the field out here and give people those goggles, and all of a sudden they go, "Oh my God!" And I said, "Yeah, welcome to the fourth dimension."
You know, James, that's really interesting, and I particularly enjoy the fact that you use the example of the night goggles. You know, Chase Brandon, who was the leading CIA operative for Hollywood for 27 years. The issue is Chase Brandon was, this is absolutely not in dispute, this is on the public record, he was the guy in Hollywood for over two decades that screened movies. Every movie dealing with the CIA, U.S. intelligence services, and extraterrestrial life went through him. And he put his mark on those movies, so that that's why you never get movies that show the CIA or the U.S. intelligence services in a bad light. They all go through this process of vetting. And he was the guy who did it for over two and a half decades. Now, this is not in dispute. And Chase Brandon, who is like one of the highest CIA operatives ever, came out, what is it, about a month ago on Huffington Post as well as late night radio, and made and stated without any ambiguity that he was shown, that he had seen complete evidence that in fact the Roswell incident did occur. It was an alien spacecraft, and he said a few other things, but very little. But he said without ambiguity, it was not like weather balloons or anything like that. So the issue is, if you combine that with Colonel Corso's stuff of the book The Day After Roswell, now the military never refuted Day After Roswell, and the CIA was asked by the media after Chase Brandon made his statement a month ago, and they have not backed down either. So the issue of whether there are extraterrestrials, whether there are UFOs, that is really not in dispute anymore. However, that does not mean that the world recognizes it yet. I guess they're still waiting for the President of the United States to make an announcement. But the issue is, it's really among people who are capable of putting two and two together, and that's a real big thing, to be intellectually capable. Mm-hmm. It's not in dispute anymore. You can't get higher than Chase Brandon, and the U.S. government, the CIA, is not backing away from this. So the issue is that if the extraterrestrials do exist, then everything else we've been talking about is entirely plausible. Mm-hmm. And with regard to vertical transportation and horizontal transportation, you know, locations of places elsewhere in the electromagnetic spectrum. Basically, the best way to think of everything, and this is basically comes out of a generalization of quantum mechanics that is due to Hugh Everett, a physicist who wrote his dissertation in 1957 under John Wheeler in Princeton, was widely scoffed at the time, left physics and went into the Defense Department, where he worked on the nuclear weapons programs, that everything essentially is a generalization of quantum mechanics, and that you, me, Mars, Venus, Earth, everything that exists not as a discrete entity, a single object that's just there and nowhere else, but it exists as a probabilistic smear across all dimensions and time and space. So what we see is when we go to Mars, we are going to one version of Mars that we get there through horizontal space travel. But Mars actually exists as a smear where there's infinite varieties of that planet. And physicists originally scoffed at that idea because they didn't like the idea of there being multiple versions of them. Einstein used to say things like, God doesn't play with dice. There's got to be just one version of us. And he used to actually mock his quantum mechanical colleagues when they were putting two and two together and say, do you really think that the moon wouldn't be there if I didn't look at it? Or do you think that there might be other versions of us, really? And so when you know, you get sort of big people arguing these things, it's because of psychological barriers that are stopping them from putting the logical facts together and to coming up with conclusions. But the reality now is really clear. Hugh Everett was right. There are multiple versions of us. And we also know now that aggregations, collective aggregations of things, can occur in places that interact with the electromagnetic spectrum at different locations other than the visible light band, so that we can have sort of higher density places. And those beings, when they come here through vertical and horizontal space travel, they've got to adapt. It's hard for them in their natural form, almost impossible for them in their natural form, to exist where we exist. So the idea of having other vehicles, other bodies that are genetically adapted to our particular setting on Earth makes total sense.
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. We filmed things here where we've seen these ships actually bilocate from one to as many as three or four ships and then back to one again. And they appear, disappear. We have jets chasing them, and they just disappear, and the jet goes by, and they reappear right behind it.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Oh, and the thing I forgot to mention with regard to the glasses, the night glasses that you were talking about, though, that technology came out of the Roswell crash.
There's
a whole bunch of technology that we now use, including the computers that we're now using to communicate over Skype. All of that came out of the crash ship stuff that we've been taking and putting into the defense industry or other industries to let them get patents on it, piece by piece by piece, re-engineering these things.
Yeah, but fiber optics and microwave, too, I guess, came from those crash sites.
This explosion over the last 50 years of technology has been mostly just reverse engineered stuff.
You know, my grandmother was involved in that, and my whole family came out of Carlsbad, New Mexico. But they had the hardware store, and they sold a lot of the equipment to the Swensons, I believe was the ranch there. And they knew the first responders, the sheriffs, were really good friends. And he came down, and he just gave her the whole lowdown. And he was having a cup of coffee with her, and he could not even hold the coffee cup. His hand was shaking so much. And his whole reality was turned upside down. And he totally goes, look, well, I'm not supposed to talk about this, but he goes, we're not alone. And he said, I don't know what to do with this. He said, he was a very good Christian man. He said, this is turning my whole world upside down. And they were shaking. Him and his whatever deputy, he said he could not even hold a cup of coffee. And she said, these are good old boys. You know, they're honest as the day is long, salty with the guys. And she said that, I have no doubt whatsoever in his story when he told it to me because of the emotional impact it had on him.
Absolutely. And now we know it was true. I mean, the whole story that originally it was, they said it was weather balloons, and then they changed that to different things. The story actually evolved over the years. And so it was clear that every time the story evolved, they were admitting that the first story was a lie, that the previous story was a lie. But mainstream media just kept on. It was amazing as mainstream media says, okay, now we know. It's obviously the viral information going out about Roswell kept on going. And obviously mainstream media was watching it, because when the government would come out with a new explanation of what it was, they dutifully reported it as, oh, now we know, as if they had been talking about it earlier. But the reality is the viral communication of this information has just been going nonstop ever since. And what people don't say is, well, if the government was lying the first time, why should we believe them when they change the story the second time or the third time? It's fascinating to see it.
Well, but why do now we expect disclosure from people who have lied to us repeatedly? Why do we expect them to tell the truth? I don't get that. It's like somebody with a long history of lying to you, and you keep asking them for the truth. At what point do you just go, wait a second, what's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, something's wrong with that picture, but that's what they do. I actually believe that the leadership of the country matches the consciousness of the people, the large majority of the people. And so when you find that the leadership is lying to or deceiving the populace, I don't think of it in the sense of the leadership being bad and they're duping a otherwise, you know, wanting to know populace. I think of them as cooperative, and that the populace didn't want to know and they were hiding it from them. Because if you just go up to people that are in a bus and start talking about this stuff, 9 times out of 10, you'll hear them, you know, change the subject, turn away from you. They don't want to engage these facts.
Yeah.
But there are a percentage of the people, and that percentage is growing exponentially, that do want to engage this information. And that means our populace is changing. And this may, in fact, be related to the post-2012 Earth changes that were so surprising in our so-called climate project, now called the post-2012 Earth Changes Project, that we did. Apparently, major change actually is headed towards us, and we will know if our remote viewing information about that, which is extremely detailed, and those are the only hard data that exist anywhere with respect to, that were collected under squeaky clean scientific conditions with unbelievable randomization controls that describe the nature of the results, the nature of the Earth changes that are expected between now and June 1st, 2013. So we're only months away from knowing about that. Oh, by the way, I should also mention that if these Earth changes that are described in our remote viewing data do occur, then the issue of mainstream science acknowledging the reality of remote viewing as a real event, as a real phenomenon, is over, because people will just say, they will simply know. We're very public about these results, and we're all over the airwaves, and the issue will not be in dispute anymore by anyone.
Oh, yeah.
My fear, however, is that when that does happen, if these major Earth changes do happen, and my theory that I've developed associated with that is, when large enough events occur, they basically affect all timelines, and this produces like a juggernaut that all timelines have to fit through. So if these data are correct, and I believe they are, then all of the timelines have to get through it, and that means you can make a prediction that these Earth changes will happen. And if that does happen, in times in the past on our planet when major disruptions occurred, what has happened? Well, look at the French Revolution in the late 1700s. You got the Reign of Terror, where people were chopping off the heads of aristocrats and leaders everywhere. And look what happened. That was really only stopped by the rise of Napoleon. And in other places like Weimar Republic, Germany, you had Hitler's coming out of chaos, and you had Stalin's coming out of chaos. So my fear is that if mainstream science doesn't acknowledge the reality of remote viewing prior to the completion of this experiment, then, which is June 1st, 2013, then there's a possibility that the anarchy that might result from it would produce a superstitious-led mass public that would turn away not only from governmental leadership, but also mainstream scientific leadership. And that would be the risk of actually moving forward in time without the guidance of reason. And I am a scientist, so I don't want that to happen. So I think it's in scientists, in the best interests of mainstream science, for them to acknowledge the reality of remote viewing sooner rather than later, so that when the changes do happen, the masses will turn to the mainstream science and say, okay, you guys were honest with us, let's build a future that is unimaginably great together, guided by scientific reason. That's my argument.
Yeah, I agree 100%. The you know, I'd love to open up a few envelopes on you that I'm sure you've already opened, but the I know a lot of people are talking about economic collapse and
sure.
And I don't know if you have any timelines on that, or I know they keep propping it up, and it should have collapsed a long time ago, but they keep propping
actually,
it up.
Actually, that's very fascinating. Let me basically state some results from the post-2012 Earth changes. And again, on the DVD, the entire thing is put together with also the understanding of multiple timelines. Mm-hmm. That whole thing has to be, it's a complicated thing that you have to understand together, and that DVD, The Farsight Experiments, is where to get it. But the basic results is, we looked at various places, Vaitupu Tuvalu, Fort Jesus, Sydney Opera House, Mount Kilimanjaro, United States Congress Building, Mali International Airport in the Maldives, KITV building, which is a television station in Honolulu, Hawaii, Key West, Florida. We looked at those places in three locations, actually, 2008, June 1st, and then two separate timelines, June 1st, 2013. So that basically those targets at two different locations in time. And basically what we found was, really briefly, is impacts from what appears to be large meteors leading to tsunamis or actually displacement waves, very high displacement waves, and possible volcanism. Extensive and forceful flooding of coastal areas, excessive solar radiation and storms and other severe weather. We also found the massive self-organized relocation from coastal areas. We're talking refugees. We're talking about also the breakdown of rescue or other notable governing functions. There was no National Guard, no rescue helicopters in any of these data. The breakdown of the food supply system and the breakdown of the vehicular transport system, an extensive loss of buildings near coast. Now, this was originally a climate project, so looking for small changes. So that's why we focus so much on the coast. We don't have any data for really inland areas. But the basic idea is, if these results are correct, this gets to your question that you popped out of the envelope, which is, well, you know, if these data are correct, then, and I do think they are, then the government would already know about whatever is going to be happening, and they would be making plans. And there are some really strange anomalies that are occurring, and one of them is the economic stuff that you just mentioned. But a couple ones also that really fit into this is the complete shutting down of the U.S. manned space flight program. We have a commitment going back to Gemini, Mercury days, Apollo and everything, and we have completely closed it down. And it's as if they're painting it as if the PhDs in NASA simply woke up one morning and said, oh my gosh, we forgot we needed a replacement for the space shuttle. What are we supposed to do?
Yeah.
And so, but like, that's so stupid. They need to pay their mortgages as well, and they're people. So this is a planned shutdown of the U.S. manned spaceflight program for reasons that they're not saying.
Yeah.
Also, we have the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, and that's been finished now. And that has every agricultural seed on the entire planet, and they had to finish by now. And that is very odd in terms of timing, why it had to be finished now. And you could say, well, this is just a quirky Norwegian project. Well, if it was a quirky Norwegian project, why did the head of the United Nations and his entire staff formally inspect the facility? So these are sort of anomalies. And then the economic stuff that you just mentioned, which is the incredible debt that's not payable, the devaluing of the U.S. dollar and the eventual devaluing of the U.S. Treasury bonds that Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch have predicted. It's as if they're pulling out all of the economic resources, basically trying to time it for around the end of the year. I mean, they're pulling out resources.
Definitely. Stop,
and they're not planning on sort of having a sustainable economy afterwards. It's clear. In addition to other anomalies, such as digging, there's digging all over the place. Now, I'm not criticizing the U.S. by any means, but our culture thinks in terms of saving the military and the elite. That's the way we think. And I'm not criticizing that, honestly. But if you look at where we dig, we have these huge facilities underneath military bases in the inhospitable West where the masses cannot get to. But on the other hand, the Chinese and Russians always think collectively. And I'm not comparing one to the other in a better or worse than sense. It's just a difference in culture. Mm-hmm. Chinese and Russians always say, those who win are those who have the most people left. And they think collectively. Now, China is building in a crash program up to 200 miles of subways under each of their major cities. Now, these subways sometimes go nowhere. And the subways are so interesting because it's a project that has to be finished this year. It's been going on for some years. It's a crash program, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And it's to be finished this year. And you're sort of saying, why the rush? If you're going to put that many subways, why not stretch it out another 20 years? But it's got to be finished this year. Russia has announced in 2011 that it was going to add a rapid emergency 5,000 new nuclear bomb shelters in Moscow to complement the existing 5,000, plus the subway system that was built deeper than needed in Russia allows them to house all citizens in Moscow completely. Every citizen in Moscow will have a place. Now, and it's got to be finished this year. This is a rush program that's being finished now. Now, the question is, with all this digging, both in the United States and China and Russia, there are no nuclear enemies. Why the rush? There are no nuclear enemies. Who's going to bomb Russia? Who's going to bomb China? Who's going to bomb the U.S.? There are no enemies. Why the rush for everything to be finished this year? These are anomalies, James, that people are not really putting two and two together, but I am putting two and two together. I'm saying this is very strange stuff. So it indicates that the post-2012 Earth changes that we have found in our remote viewing data, and again, these are the only hard data that exist with respect to these post-2012 changes. So other people can say they have visions, they have this, but these data were collected by the best remote viewers on the planet Earth with typically over a decade of experience with huge publicly verified track records for accuracy using military and military-derived methodologies, working with the best of people, and all of their history is publicly verified right here on the Institute website. And this study had all of the scientific controls. I don't have time to go into it, but the level of randomization that was used to control the targeting under totally blind conditions was just so over the top. Typically, after I describe the level of scientific controls put into this study, people have to go to a chiropractor afterwards because it twists their head around so much.
Yeah.
So these data are absolutely pristine in terms of how they were collected. And the suggestion is that, you know, once we get a little farther down the line, we'll be able to close this experiment on June 1st, 2013. And then the issue of whether remote viewing works is over.
Yeah.
And then the question is, what do we do next? And that's the time period that we need to think about for rebuilding a civilization that will be, you know, grander, better, more wonderful than anything that in the galaxy.
Well, it does tie into all the Native American prophecies, and I know, I know there's, yeah, I'm probably going to get some a lot of crap for this, but there's the love and lighters, you know, that say that's fear porn, you know, and they get all upset, and I've had to deal with that. I actually saw the San Francisco earthquake, and it's well documented, and I gave the exact date and time and of the event and the magnitude, but the first, I said 6.9, which was the first reading, and then they changed, I think, to 7.4 later. And I went on Jim Berkland's side as well and talked about the one that hit Seattle a while back. But, you know, I got so much crap from this. I mean, I got basically thrown out of the Unity Church, several other meditation groups. When I was down in Santa Cruz, I told them this was coming and when it was coming. And, you know, I got called every name in the book. And then after it happened, when I went back, they said I created it. You know, they said...
You know, it's a difficult situation. Mind you, it is very difficult. It's essentially, it's very difficult to make any prediction of the future in a context of multiple timelines.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there are multiple timelines and you perceive something, it's not clear what future you're perceiving.
Yeah.
And so what we have done with the Multiple Universes Project is specifically test for the existence of multiple realities by controlling for, I found a way to control for a single and only one future, and then to see if we can correctly predict that future and only one future using something called the temporal outbounder. Again, in the DVD, I explained it totally, the science, and that project, the data, the experiments were published in that leading peer-reviewed journal. People really should read that and see how really amazing that experiment was. But in a context of multiple realities, unless you do those extra controls, it's almost impossible to actually predict the future. However, the basic theory I've been developing is the larger the event, the more timelines are affected by it. Mm-hmm. So with an earthquake, some parallel realities will experience a devastating earthquake. And then other parallel realities on the same day will perceive a much more moderate earthquake. And so people who don't understand the complexities of a multiple reality existence will often scoff at things if a prediction doesn't turn out to be exactly right, mm-hmm. because the timeline control has not been actually made. But it just goes to show that we're living in a much more complex reality than we ever thought we were. But that's been the whole history of the growth of science. People often scoff at things. For example, when Copernicus said that the Earth revolved around the Sun rather than the Sun revolving around the Earth, people scoffed at that. They said that was so stupid. And the argument that they said was, Copernicus, you're such a jerk. If the Earth was revolving around the Sun, we'd feel it. I'm not being thrown around or anything. We're still. And obviously the Sun and the Moon and the planets, they're all revolving around us because we're not moving. We're not feeling anything.
Yeah.
But see, they didn't understand at that time of the time of Copernicus. They had not yet experienced the Newton. They had not yet experienced the understanding that Newton brought to classical mechanics, which is force equals mass times acceleration. They didn't understand that they were on the Earth and part of the system that was also orbiting the Sun. They didn't get all of that. Their science was not that well evolved. So when you talk about predictions and multiple realities, people often say, oh gosh, so your prediction went wrong because you say it was in another universe. Oh gosh. But the reality is they don't understand how complex things actually are. But we have found a way to actually test for multiple realities, and we did it. But the also thing is that the post-2012 Earth changes, our data, I'm very sensitive to the issue that you raised with regard to fear porn. Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. But the issue is this, all I'm saying is I'm not making a deterministic prediction. In fact, I've said repeatedly, I cannot do that. But what I am saying is the theory is the bigger the event, the more timelines are affected by it. Mm-hmm. Thus, I cannot predict a single timeline in a situation like this, but I can say in sufficiently large, if the event is planetary in its nature, then according to the theory, basically all timelines have to fit through that juggernaut. And so I can say in this particular situation, the probability of the events is very high. And then I say the evidence of anomalous activity of governmental authorities also suggests that they are preparing in such a manner for this type of a thing. And so I just leave the data for what it is, and I say, you decide, but understand the clear conditions under which these data were collected, and then, you know, make your own decision. But I think the data are absolutely unambiguous.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've had dreams and visions of these things, and I've seen these events happen. You know, as far as where they happen on the timeline or exactly when, that takes a lot more detailed work. We have several checks and balances before I actually say anything, but it is tough, and you're putting your neck out on the line, and you can hit 10 in a row and miss one, and they're going to hold the one against you.
And discount
all the others. You know, we just got a couple minutes left, unfortunately.
Okay.
I'd love to have you guys remote viewed some of the off-world visitors, you know, such as the Greys or the Pleiadians or the Andromedans, or we're having a lot of felines showing up here lately. It's pretty interesting, but I'm curious to get your take on that.
Well, actually, I have a hobby of applying remote viewing to extraterrestrial life. However, at the Farsight Institute, I work with a lot of military guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have a tendency to shy away from the extraterrestrial application of remote viewing. And the reason is that they're afraid of bringing in the woo-woo factor into remote viewing. They want people to appreciate the reality of remote viewing without having the added baggage of having to deal with extraterrestrials. So it's not that they're opposed to extraterrestrial science, but they want to keep remote viewing separate from it. But that's not me.
Yeah.
But so independently of the Farsight Institute, I have written two best-selling books. In fact, one called Cosmic Voyage and Cosmic Explorers, where I deal with my own personal use of remote viewing to explore extraterrestrial life, including all the stuff you just talked about. And those were bestsellers in their day. They're out of print now, but they're available as free downloads as PDF files. You can read them on your computer or print them out or on your book reader, your e-book reader. And they can be found on my personal website, which is just simply myname.com, which is CourtneyBrown.com. And go into the area called speculative nonfiction, and there it is. And, at this point, I like to keep track of how many things have been verified in those books. And now that we've got the Chase Brandon stuff out and so on, it's becoming increasingly obvious that the books are very accurate. I expect Cosmic Voyage will eventually be found to be about 75% accurate. Mm-hmm. And again, people can read it now if they'd like. It's available free. So
great. We're at the end of the hour here. We're definitely going to have to – I know we could probably do a three-hour show with you, but at least. But we're at the end of the hour. So what's the best way for people to get in contact with you and get a hold of your information?
Great. Well, I'm always welcome to come back, and it's an honor for me to be here, so thank you, James. But the best way to get in touch with what we're doing right now is to go to our website, which is www.farsight.org, because we're a nonprofit. We have a newsletter that you can click. There's a banner in the upper left called Click Here to subscribe to our free newsletter. We rarely send one out, about once a month, so this is not an issue of spam. And if you want to sort of keep up with the latest things we're doing, that's the place to do it. And the next thing you should do, the very first thing after signing up for the newsletter, is to watch the DVD, The Farsight Experiments, because rather than try to figure out independently everything that we've done so much. Just that's what the DVD was designed to do. You sit down and in one presentation, you get this whole bunch of stuff, and afterwards you say, oh my gosh, so that's what you do. I get.
Yeah.
And really the place to start. And then if you're a reader, I mean, there's tons of other stuff, which is to read the recently peer-reviewed publication in the Journal of Scientific Exploration. That link is right on our homepage. But to get started, the newsletter and the DVD, that will really get you started.
Great.
And then from then on, we have, following what we do is an endless process that's filled with interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We're out of time, unfortunately, and great interview. We'll definitely get you back on soon because I really want to get into these ultra-dimensional aspects of remote viewing.
This was a great overview show, and if we come back and do some things, we can focus on some of the individual projects, which that's really are fascinating.
Okay, great. Hey, well, thanks again for coming on the show, and have a great day.
It's my pleasure, and it's also my honor. Thank you so much.
We're out of time, folks. This is James Gillen signing off. Have a great evening, and watch the skies. A lot going on, and pay attention to what's happening under your feet as well. Greetings. This is James Gillen. I'm your host. We've got another great show. We've got Cynthia Robbins on the show. And Cynthia Robbins was born in Salem, Oregon, was raised on a local farm. She attended Silverton High School and moved on to college, earning her Bachelor of Science in Psychology from Western College University. Cynthia professionally works with youth offenders, teaching life skills and critical thinking for more than 12 years. Cynthia loves to express herself artistically and recently found that writing a book is an art form by placing the right words together to form sentences, paragraphs, and chapters to paint a picture for others to view her mystical visions. The Light Warrior is her first novel, opening a new medium as she continues to write both books and screenplays. Cynthia is passionate about metaphysical concepts, trying to unbend her mind. The last 14 years involved devout study in such subjects as quantum physics, sacred geometry, cosmology, the 2012 phenomenon, and human origins. Cynthia strives to inspire others to find inner greatness to light their own candle in the world. So without any further ado, I want to bring Cynthia on the show. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Great. Yeah, a little technical difficulty in the beginning, but it looks like we're back, and hopefully we can get through this show without being taken out by a massive solar flare, which is hitting us as we speak. I wanted to cover some of the things and just get in the beginning about what actually inspired you to start off in this journey of writing and research into the alien phenomena.
Well, I've always been fascinated with the mystical world. I think it's always been with me, a part of me. And I used to be terrified of the spiritual realm, I guess. And I had to confront my own fears. And so about 14, 15 years ago, I started trying to learn about what of these ideas were in regards to life after death, aliens, ghosts, things like that. And so I tried to study whatever I could to understand it. So for all the time, for 15 years, I did this deep research, and I decided, well, what am I going to do with this information? So I decided to write a science fiction fantasy book to try to tell a story, to try to translate some of the big concepts that I was learning over the years and to put it in a fictional story so that an average reader could try to learn about metaphysics.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of the people in the mainstream are starting to open up to a greater reality, and it seems like they're very hungry now for new information.
Yes, definitely. And I've seen that a lot with the people that I interact with and I talk to. It seems like a lot more people are opening to a lot of these ideas in regards to aliens, and they want to know how it works and why people believe the way they do. And so I love talking about mystical world, though. It's my favorite subject.
Mm-hmm. I know, you know, with the youth, I mean, if you could incorporate that into the youth counseling, but you'd probably get thrown out the door immediately. But, you know, I've always felt that, you know, the subject of ETs and paranormal and all these things with some good mentorship could actually re-steer a lot of the youth into a very positive direction. And I think one of the problems we're having right now is that a lot of the youth are awake and they're not fitting into the mold that's being created for them. And they're trying to find something a little more expanded, a little more open-minded. And that is one of the problems with the youth today, is that they're not here to conform to this society. They're here to change it.
Absolutely. I see that. I've been in the field for 13 years, and I've seen these kids just hungry for this information. They want to talk about, the universe is. They don't even know. A lot of kids don't even know the planet, the solar system. The education system is just isn't there, or they're learning. And so I have long talks with kids about just the basics, cosmology, and atoms and how they work, and they will talk for hours about conspiracies. I love that stuff. I love talking to them about it. But
yeah, it does seem that definitely the conspiracy theories, they're very much into that, and they aren't buying the mainstream propaganda machine and questioning it at every angle. I wanted to talk further about, you were talking about how we need to change the concepts and images about aliens.
Yeah, we do. So many of the people that I do talk with, they think instantly about little green men. The movies always put out, the movie Alien, or Scary Aliens. Most of we're focused on the negative alien image, but really, there are good aliens out there.
Oh, yeah.
And in my book, I wrote about what an intelligent, nice alien would be. I mean, what would it look like, and how would it, how would we interact with these aliens? And so, one of the aliens that I put in my book is Isadora. She is a character, and she comes from the Pleiades, and she travels from her Merkaba, which is where she is her light body, and she comes to Earth, and she can be seen if you have the eye to see it with your psychic guide, and she interacts with Blue, and she is her spirit guide. So that is another form of an alien that I wrote in the story.
Yeah, and so you call this fiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny. One man's fiction is another man's reality, but it sounds like my life story basically.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think it's awesome that you're putting this information out, and it probably needs to be done as a fictional book, but as in all a lot of books that are out there, they're actually telling, they're foretelling the future or telling about what's really going on, if again if people have the ears to hear it and the eyes to see it.
Yeah, I do. I believe in aliens. Always have. I guess I was raised in a home that taught those things, so it's something that I've had to learn on my own. And I used to have these wild, vivid dreams about UFOs as a kid, and we didn't. I don't even think we had a TV. I was at least 7, maybe 8. Year old, so I wasn't really exposed to a lot of those ideas. And I'm 40 years old, so back then we would have had a black and white TV.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a whole lot of TV watching, and I wasn't exposed. So I used to have these wild and vivid dreams that I just can't explain. And I think that a lot of us come here. I believe we're searching, having a physical experience, and I talk about that in the book. And many of us have a message for this, when we come here, and it's up to us to either choose to do good or to do bad. And I decide I want to be on the good side. And I'm hoping to try to educate other people about these ideas.
I know the what I've seen, especially with Hollywood, they do paint a very dark, foreboding picture, and that's their job to get people into the box office, and you can't do it, unless you have fear and suspense, and if you have to go by the formula, boy meets girl, boy saves girl, together they save the humans from the aliens, or they have these formulas, and without them, I've had producers come up here. And that's exactly what they said. They said, if I don't follow this formula, this will never make it. We have to gear it around this formula. And I said, well, why not just tell the truth? The truth is more bizarre than the fiction. So why not just, the truth was pretty exciting, especially in my experience. And I won't mention his names, but some very, very famous actors have actually written some checks, for my life story to do it, and I turned them down, only because they wanted to change the whole nature of the experience and make it, suspenseful and fearful and have some shoot 'em up scenes and all these other things and some of those things happened. I've had bullets whiz by my head, and I've had my vehicles sabotaged and threats and things like that, but it's like, I don't know, that's not the story.
Right.
The story is, who are these beings? Why are they here? And why are they such a threat?
Right. Why is it such a threat to get information out? Why is it that the United States hasn't really come out and announced it, that ET is already here? And that's the big question.
I tell you, my understanding of it is that there's several reasons why they're trying to keep this under wraps. One is the elite have pretty much hijacked the technology that they've gleaned from the crash site, such as Roswell, and Germany had some amazing technology in the past, back in the probably the 20s. There was so much information out there, and the old saying is, he who has the best technology wins the war, So I can understand, in the interest of national security, how they would want to back engineer this and get on top of it, and things of that nature. But the problem with that is that the powers that be, or I should say, the powers that were, the oil conglomerates and the war industry and all these other things, would be rendered pretty much useless. If these extremely advanced beings showed up, which they are, and there's nothing they can do about them. They can come and go at will. They can pop in and out of dimensions. Their technology is so advanced, there's really nothing we can do about it. The other thing is that they do have advanced technology. They have fuelless energy. They have countergravity, anti-gravity. They can warp time and space, and so they have these amazing technologies that would be, a direct threat to the oil industries, and they have healing technologies that are beyond our imagination, which would be a direct threat to the pharmaceutical industry. So here you have a threat to the war industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the oil industry. All of these industries would almost be rendered useless with the presence of an extremely advanced, race of beings. And to me, that's why, UFOs have a higher security clearance than nuclear weapons. But it's all about money and control, basically. Keep everybody enslaved through dependency, and keep people dumbed down, and don't let them realize that they just might be connected to these beings. They might be part of their extended family, and there may be some both genetic and family tree or soul family connections that equate greatness.
The whole story of The Light Warrior, the book I wrote, it's a message about Lucy Hayes, and she is an alien, but she doesn't know it. She doesn't know that she's an alien until she meets a handsome stranger that actually teaches her that she has a mission to accomplish. And when she goes to this ancient stone, which I envisioned your ranch, the orbs and the intelligent orbs swirling around, and she stands on the same stone and activates the vision, and she starts to be able to see this other realm with her eyes because it opens up her third eye, and she realizes, oh wow, there's a whole other reality going on that she never saw before. But so she's an alien, she doesn't know it, she was born here, and she has this quest to unveil the past, to reveal that he was enslaved 13,000 years ago by a sinister alien force. And about telling the truth about, I believe that there was an alien invasion that did take place thousands of years ago. And many people on this planet don't know. But thankful for shows like this and ancient aliens on television. We're beginning to question this. We're beginning to educate people that there's a much deeper history that needs to be revealed to the people, so that because we will not save our future unless we unveil the past. That's the biggest key right there. If we unveil the past, we save our future.
I agree. The It seems like, anybody with a questioning mind would look back at the history books, and you know, with Michael Cremo's work, it shows that there were you know, extremely advanced cultures here at least 600 million years ago, and civilizations have come and gone due to pole shifts and other, you know, meteor impacts and all kinds of things that have happened here on the Earth. So you know, it's very obvious just in the geological records and by the great structures that were left behind and the ancient cities they continue to find and dig up that, you know, there were some very advanced beings here. And you know, all the Vedic, you know, the Vedics, the scriptures, all of these from all these different cultures all point back to people with vimanas and flying ships and extreme technology and weapons and nuclear wars and just all kinds of crazy things. So, you know, to me, if you do the research, obviously, you know, it's very, very clear that beings have come and gone, and I think some were of good intent and some were of ill intent.
Yeah, and we can't think that this little green men either. They could be all kinds of different species, and they come from all throughout the entire universe. We don't know exactly what they're made of or what they look like. And it's time to just open up the door and realize they probably look a lot like humans too.
Well, definitely. I know from the ancient, you know, research that, you know, a lot of the life did not originate here on Earth, and that it is throughout the cosmos, and different beings have come and gone and colonized the planet and brought some of their genetics, you know, both human, animal, and plant genetics, you know, here to the planet. And the higher beings call this place this just massive genetic, you know, zoo down here, that we have stuff from all kinds of different star systems, genetics and both plant, animal, and human. So we're just a big soup down here, and I think that's why they think this needs to be preserved, because it's this grand experiment with 12 major star nations involved in the beginning, but others have added their tinkering to the lot as well. Yeah, that does correspond with the book, and I find it too that, you know, it's interesting you picked the Pleiades. I know, you know, this is kind of a little bit of a downer note, but I know that the Billy Murray folks talk about how there isn't anybody at the Pleiades, that he just made up that story to trap people, and that they're really Plagiarans. But what's interesting about the Pleiades is that the pyramids are aligned with them. They're aligned with Orion as well. You look at all the ancient indigenous people, you ask them where, you know, what their origins are, and they point to the Pleiades, or they mention the Pleiades. I know a lot of the Lakota and the Hawaiian, the Hunas, all point to the Pleiades. I know in Indonesia too, they point up to the Philippines, they point at the Pleiades, you know, as their base of origin. So, you know, this has been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, I've always felt like that there was something where important about the Pleiades, and I did pick it purposely because a lot of the native cultures have stories of the Pleiades. So there's a lot of references from our native cultures that point to that constellation being very important, that's where human origins began.
Mm-hmm. I know the same thing with the Cherokee Nation, that, you know, I'm part of that one, but they also point at the Pleiades and talk a lot about the Seven Sisters, you know, and legends about that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, Lucy comes from the Pleiades. Uh-huh. She finds out later. Her friend Isadora, who is also from the Pleiades, who has the ability to travel back and forth, she tells her all about her home planet as she read on through the book. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I like that the media, which is in cahoots with the powers that be, they own the media basically, and they're the ones really promoting, to keep people in fear and suspense around the ETs and the little green men or the little bug-eyed aliens or insects coming to, turn us into human pilaf or reptiles. It's just like, it's amazing how all of that has so much press, and that's been pushed so hard. But you're going, where, whatever happened to the benevolent movies like the first E.T., and Cocoon and things like that, which really had a message, a very powerful message in them. It's just all been overshadowed by the Hollywood, fear and suspense and action drama.
Yeah, like Independence Day or
Yeah.
especially the alien movies or the Wisconsin, especially that gave me chills.
Yeah.
I know that, just like if we look at Star Wars or Star Trek, I mean, there's good and there's the bad. And we look at humanity, we have that. I don't think that things would be any different from humans where they either are service to self or service to others. And I really pointed that out in the book too, is there really is the dark brotherhood. That's what I call them in the book. Those are themselves, and those are the ones that invaded a long time ago. And in the story, of course, it's fictional, but it's based on real conspiracies that are out there that they enslaved humanity and tried to suppress our memories of their presence. And possibly they could be creating this new world order that we are hearing about all the time in the media. I mean, it's very likely that they could be behind that.
Yeah, it's most likely that they're behind it. You know, we've had long,
Exactly.
yeah, we've had long conversations out in the field about that, and I gave you a little bit about my take on it, is that like a politician, we'll start off good, and in order to get elected, he's going to need the money, so he's going to have to tell a few little lies here and there, and push some agendas ordinarily he wouldn't. And then as he goes further along, he gets deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole, and he has to tell a few more lies and do a few more little bennies and corrupt actions. And then by the time he gets up to the end of his career, he's fully corrupted and just an open gateway to some pretty dark forces, because his whole focus is on power and wealth, basically, and control over others or domination, and those are the beings that he's aligned himself with. So, and these can be negative ETs, or these can be demonic type beings or lower astral beings. There's all kinds of beings that are in total service to self and feed off of negativity. But I've always felt the vast majority, especially in the ET world, the vast majority are benevolent. And you've got the angelic kingdoms, the nature spirits, and the ascended masters, but there are some rogue elements out there that are cruising around the universe, wreaking havoc, and unfortunately, are the people that are gravitate to these positions of power are a perfect feeding ground for these entities.
Right. I find it interesting that when I have conversations with people who debate this topic, those who are kind of fearful from the topic itself, they say, "Well, it's not in the Bible." Well, actually, it is. You just look at the stories about the fallen angels or the Nephilim or there's a lot of references in our ancient documents.
Ezekiel's a good one. In the Bible, they talk about a shiny disc that comes out of the firmament, and it has bronze feet like calves, and fire and brimstone coming out from underneath it. And when it lands, it sounds like 1,000 rushing rivers. And after it lands, supposedly God steps out of it, and along with cherubim, which were wheels with flashing lights all around them. You look at that today and you go, wow, that was an encounter. There's no doubt. And if an extremely advanced civilization were to show up on, to a primitive culture, whatever, they would be revered as gods. People would mistake them as gods or the god.
Mm-hmm.
But, that just makes common sense to me. But if you go further into that story, if you want to get into the wrathful god, this guy steps out of this massive ship, whatever you want to call it, and he orders six of his men to destroy all the men, women, and children of Israel with their shattering weapons. And you go, okay, wait a second. We're talking about a day of bows and arrows and spears, maybe a sling or two. What are these? How can they lay a whole city to waste? Six men come in, lay a whole city to waste with shattering weapons. And only six guys. I mean, that's some pretty extreme weaponry that these guys are carrying. And then he orders one of the men dressed in all white linen to reach in the bowels of the cherubim and spread hot coals around the city. It says, henceforth, anybody who comes here will die a hideous death. Their hair and fingernails will fall out, and there'll be food for the raven and the beast for the next 100 years. So, you look at that with today's knowledge or wisdom, and you go, boy, that's radiation.
Yeah. You get it a lot differently now.
Yeah.
With the knowledge that we have now.
And so that was the Old Testament, and that was a bad encounter, and that's where people got the image of the wrathful God, from this deity.
Yeah.
But then you have the next one, there's a prophecy that says there shall come a great one that'll bruise the head of the one who bruised the head of man. And that's when they're talking about, Yeshua ben Joseph or Jesus. And he came in with the God of love and peace and some other beings and kicked this guy out. But, if people understood the whole story, the real history of Earth, and then read the Bible, they'd have a much greater understanding. Yeah. Because it never made sense to me. I said, why would a god force people to eat their dung, lay to waste village after village, bash children's heads out on rocks, slay all the men, women, and children,
and the blood sacrifices.
Yeah, and child sacrifices and all these things. I just go, who is this guy? And do I want to follow him? And then next you got this all forgiving God of love and joy, and peace. This guy's all forgiving. You're going, wait a second, this does not add up unless you understand the real history of the earth.
Yeah. That's what we need to know, is the real history.
Yeah.
I mean, it exists. It's out there for us to uncover. I've always kind of been frustrated with the fact that why isn't the real history out for all of us to know? That's my biggest quest, is to try to unveil it on my own. Mm-hmm. And what I do find out and share it with other people. But even on my journey of trying to learn, it's constantly evolving. It's constantly changing based on receiving more and more knowledge. Every day I learn something new, and then I have to shift gears on, like, I'll have to look at it differently again. I mean, there's just so much to learn about our past.
Exactly. I don't, to me, that never added up, because, how can you have a God that's all-loving and all-forgiving be a jealous, wrathful, genocidal maniac?
Mm-hmm.
Something doesn't work. either we have a total schizophrenic God, and I've asked Christians about this, and they said, well, God has his ways, and we're not to question that, And so I go, well, wait a second, why were you given a brain? Why were you given the ability to question, and critical thinking and things like that? I said, there's a reason for it. Do you think it was a mistake? Like, whoops, we threw a little too much DNA into this one, or something, it doesn't make any, none of that makes any sense to me. And when you start asking those critical questions, you get the wrath of God, coming through humans, unfortunately.
Right.
But I think that's coming from fear. They are still running the fear program of, being turned into toast, or losing favor of God by asking basic questions or using base logic. And, I think that's really sad. And I find out, too, with myself, I could not love God or worship God with the image I was given. I just couldn't do it. I said, I'm really trying here, but this guy's done some really nasty things, and they just don't work for me. And I don't care who he is. I would rather just hang out with my dad.
Exactly.
My dad would not burn me in hell everlasting for making a mistake here or there, or sacrifice me or do any of these things. It just wouldn't happen. My dad was more like a walking Buddha. He just lived it. But I think about that. Well, God, if my dad was really cool, can't God do a little better than that? It's like,
yeah, we just have to do some critical thinking. Say, hey, this doesn't make sense. If this is a loving God, what is the deal with the Old Testament? Why is God being portrayed as the God?
Yeah, why did they go to the land of milk and honey and just, these were peaceful people that lived in total harmony, and they had no hierarchy there, and everybody was equal, and they thrived. They lived a very abundant life in peace. And why did he go and destroy these people? It makes no sense to me whatsoever. Why would an all-loving, all-forgiving God destroy these people just because they wouldn't bend their knee to him or acknowledge him as the supreme creator or whatever? I mean, this guy's got a real inferiority complex.
Right. Yep. He's not a good guy. Really look at the stories. I think that in the story I wrote, Lucy, the main character, she has a problem with evil. At first, she started off in her journey. Mm-hmm. She doesn't understand why there are so many dark things in this world. And that really disturbs her, and it causes a lot of fear to her. Mm-hmm. And she has to really learn how to confront the darkness in order to embrace the light.
I tell you what's funny. I've noticed there's people here on Earth that are more played in their soul than anything else. And they do struggle with that. They really struggle with acknowledging that, there is darkness, or that people may not think the same way they think, or that people would even do harmful acts to humanity and the Earth. They're kind of naive in their bliss, which is a good place to hang out. But then again, it can come and bite you, because although you believe that way, that might not be another's truth. And I've noticed that people from Orion, the System of Orion, the Orion Council of Light, and that group, they had some real bad encounters with darkness. And so they're tempered, and they have a lot of wisdom around that, and they acknowledge it and they deal with it. They deal with it accordingly, and the energy is a little different. They're very loving and very brilliant, beings, but at the same time they're down to business, and they realize, that there are dark forces out there, and sometimes you have to deal with them on a level they understand.
Yeah, definitely. I think Lucy is a little bit like me. Of course, it's a fictional character, but I know that when I was younger, I had a lot of fears. I had a lot of fears to overcome, and I had to learn how to work with these energies that were bombarding me all the time. And to a lot of people, they just didn't get anxiety or there's something wrong with them. And I didn't want to think there was something wrong with me. I always did see orbs flying through my bedroom, or I would see shadows, and I was fearful. I didn't know what these were. I didn't grow up in a home that taught me that these things existed. And so I was fortunate, probably 4 years ago, to find a women's group that taught me how to use these and to protect myself from dark forces, or just to empower myself, to learn that I can control my own thoughts and my own emotions, and basically tap into my psychic abilities. And I think that we all have these abilities. They're just a lot of us don't know how to use them or how to control that. And a lot of times we don't want to see things that could be out there.
I agree. I know after my own near-death experience, I was blown wide open, and I was seeing objects morphing from an object to just energy and little sparkles of energy, and then back to a physical. And I was really having t hard time grounding for a while, and then I was seeing attachments, entities attached to people, actually sucking off their life forces. And you go into a bar and you see them all hanging there waiting, to get their fix vicariously through others, and inspiring them to drink more and more and more. So it's, observing all of this at once without the tools was really overwhelming for me. And going out of body and having all these other crazy things happen, luckily I did end up connecting with some great teachers that helped me to understand this and how to deal with it, as you were saying, it's too bad we don't have this knowledge, early on as kids, have this explained to them, learn to heal unseen negative influences, learn that there are other dimensions interfacing with us, and how to navigate through them, and learn that, that we do can go out of body. And when you do out, like when I first had my first out of body experience, I think I was about 9 years old or something, it freaked the hell out of me. I went out of body, and I got up and I was going towards the door, and I looked back and my body was still in the bed, and I just went, oh, and bam, slammed back into the body and sat there and vibrated, for about a minute waiting. It's like a bad entry, but if I had some training in that, I would have gone out of body, looked back, go, cool, I'm out of body. This is neat. Now what do I do? And have some kind of understanding or training. And I think that's really sad that we don't have that, other than, some of the black projects are doing it.
Right. And I think that's why I wrote this story in a sci-fi fantasy, and to use those teachings so that it would be part entertainment but part teaching.
Yeah, I think it's good. I mean, that's the best way to get it out. The books that I wrote are more just this is how it is, and historical, and talks about the ancient history of Earth and all the other things. And sometimes, and I actually wrote books very similar to yours, and they're still just sitting there in a box that I never finished them. And I thought about it later on. I go, boy, I should have written it that way, and make it a fiction to get that information out there, versus just bringing it straight out.
Yeah, because people like to be entertained too. I notice a lot of people do, and they learn through story.
Yeah, exactly. And my nature is I'm just blunt and to the point, bam, let's get through this. I don't hold back, and that's always been my nature. I know one time I was meditating, and Babaji appeared to me, and told me to stop watering seedlings with a fire hose, and you know it's a you know so I learned, you know, through experience, I do have to temper things down and make things more palatable for the masses.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I strive to do. I try to take these big concepts of these teachings, you know, from quantum physics to cosmology to aliens to ancient history, and I try to break it down and to translate it to people who are just beginning to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's important. I'm wondering that, you know, I think the way it's happening right now, the quickening that we're in and the energies that we're being exposed to, everything is happening so fast. You know, it's pretty amazing the way things are unfolding. And I really, my heart goes out to people that are just beginning. And I'm just, part of me is going, what are they going to do? I mean, how are they going to deal with this? This is coming so fast, so hot, so heavy. No, yeah. You know, a lot of them don't have any tools. They still have, you know, the 9-to-5 job. They're you know, going home, popping on the TV and being told what's the way the world is through the TV set, and having a beer and going comatose and waking up the next morning. And I just think about them. What, they haven't even started their journey. You know, how are they going to handle, you know, these frequencies coming in?
Yeah, I have a hard time with these frequencies.
Yeah. I think about it, even with all the tools and all the understandings and the 30 plus years of intense training with every process oriented therapy you can think of, even with all that under my belt, I mean, it's not easy for myself. You know, I still have greater challenges coming down the pike. And then I go, wow, what about the poor people that haven't even started this journey? But I guess they'll be given, you know, what they can handle in the moment.
Yeah. It's a challenge. It's a challenge for me. You know, it seems like there's so much to do in such a small amount of time.
Yeah.
And like time is speeding up, and it's really hard to keep up with everything. And with all the things to worry about in regards to the economy and possible earthquakes or tsunamis and wars. I mean, no wonder people are having a hard time. There's a lot to worry about. There's a lot of unknowns. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess it's up to us to try to calm the storm and to shine the light and try and find a new way to exist on this planet. That I ultimately believe that I want to believe that the good will overcome evil. That's mm-hmm. what it's supposed to be at every end in a movie, right?
Yeah.
Good has to overcome evil.
Yeah, exactly. The way I see it, you know, evil's not going to be frequency specific to the Earth pretty soon. And I know, you know, when you go through in the fourth dimension, there's still polarity there. But right. When you go to the fifth dimension, you don't have that program anymore. You know, the duality, good, evil, all that other stuff, you know, after the fifth. And a lot of people are already resonating on that level, you know. But I just see this old paradigm of greed, separation, control and power over others, all of these old archetypes and attitudes and emotions and kingdoms that are built on that are going to implode just because they're not frequency specific to the Earth and where her evolutionary journey is taking her.
Yeah, and I think we're tired. We're tired of a lot of these old systems. And you know, we really are slaves to the money, you know, money. We're slaves, and we need to get more connected to Earth and not having to constantly worry about just paying the electricity bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's we are enslaved through dependency, and there is a plan, you know, to keep us all in, you know, locked into the cities and the little cubicles and I know I like what Chief Seattle said. He said, when you take man out of nature, you harden his heart. And I've seen that over and over and over again, is that if people don't take the time to get out in nature and meditate and make their own personal God, creator spirit connection, whatever you want to call it, they are going to be caught, totally unaware. When things come down the pike here, and it's imperative that people start going within and listening, and listen to the land where they're sitting. Ask, is this a safe place? Is this where I need to stay? Do I need to move on? What do I need to do? And go within and start asking those questions, because a lot of people are being nagged right now, but they're just not listening.
Yeah, that can be hard. Because especially when you're living, day to day, working the job, trying to or work on goals, and you think you're moving towards, attaining a goal, and then you realize that, oh, the economy could collapse, and what am I going to do? Or it's learning how to trust your intuition and go where you need to go. But that's a real challenge. It's even a real challenge for me to try and trust that. It's like I'm constantly confused on what I need to do, if I need to stay here and help do my job, pay the bills, keep doing what I do every day, or do I head for the hills? Like a lot of people are doing. I'm not going to go head for the hills right now. I thought about it when, watching the news, and I just had to turn off the news. I don't watch TV anymore because it was just overwhelming. But there's a lot of fear out there, and it can be really hard to decide what you need to do, and it's important to get connected and to pay attention to your thoughts and that intuition to guide you to know where what to do next.
I know this little town. I mean, it's changing a little bit now and then, but it's pretty much still that way. You leave your keys in your car, you you go to the gas station, and you it's funny, or you go out to eat, and you're just there's never a problem here. It's a really wonderful town in that respect, and the people are pretty down to earth, good, good people. There's a lot of Baptist energy here, a lot of there's some Presbyterians here. I think there's like three or four Baptist churches, but we seem to get along, with them. We have just a small contingent here that would like to see us go away, but even they're dealing with this just because we've done nothing but good for the valley and helped out a lot of people. We don't quote scripture. We just be kind to each other, and the planet. We live it rather than go around and telling everybody what to do and how to live and things like that. So anyway, over the years, being here 25 years, we have a pretty good reputation here of doing nothing but helping people. So that's hard to come down on, but there are some that still believe in that wrathful God, and that they're doing that wrathful God's job, which is pretty arrogant. I think about it. Okay, if your God is omnipotent, right, all powerful, all knowing, the guy could toast me any minute. Why does he need you to act on his behalf? I mean, the guy could like turn me into a cinder any second. And so there's one of two things going on. Either you're misinformed about the nature of your guy, or it's illogical. It doesn't exist. Maybe the guy is all loving and all forgiving, and maybe we should start acting the same way. So, and master judgment and things of that nature. So, it's never made sense. But some people, it's they have a Oh God, I don't know. It's like a smug arrogance about them that they actually think they're doing the will of God by going around and judging and condemning and trying to save people that really never asked to be saved.
Yeah.
I always say, "Hey, take it up." They start telling me this and this and this and Jesus this, and I just said, "Well, I said we're buds."
Yeah.
I go, "We're buds," and this, and I go, "Hey, ask Jesus what's going on." It's like you seem to have a direct connection.
Right.
It was really funny. I go, "We're buds." I said, "We're good. All, everything's good between us." If you have any questions, ask him. And that usually nips it in the bud.
Yeah,
But
that's a good question.
yeah. But it's really important. I think it's like, we all need to get back to basics,
Yeah.
and then we're going to be good. And I know these higher beings, especially the Pleiades, are from what I've experienced, are nothing but good. I mean, they're just beautiful, almost to the point of innocence, where they have a real hard time even functioning down here in with all the psychic turbulence and all the crazy thought forms and everything else going on.
Oh yeah, I know that last week when I came to visit the ranch, I right before I was going up the hill, I was like, oh, I can't leave the job. I have so much work to do, and I have to do this, and then by the time I got up there, it was just so calm, and it was peaceful and quiet, and I was just able to reconnect, and it was the energy up there was just amazing. And our experience was incredible.
Yeah, I'd like to go into that if you wouldn't mind. I'd love to hear kind
Sure.
of your story as far as what you experienced here and what it meant and felt and how it felt.
I could instantly feel a difference when I was up there, and especially just getting disconnecting yourself from the energy of a city with all the cellular frequencies and all the commotion. It was just really peaceful to be up there, but I could just feel something as well. And when we were out there in the field, I could see something that was there that I told my husband. I said, okay, I see these three feline-looking entities. What is this all about? I had no idea. And then when I did, I met with you, you had confirmed with me that there was a feline entity, and I'm like, oh my goodness, that was confirmation that this existed to me. And then that night, when we were had the binoculars, a big, large, night vision binoculars, this big, huge orb just flew right over us, and that was amazing. And then I saw all the lights just up in the sky, getting brighter and brighter, and then just disappearing. And I saw something in the tree line that late at night, when I was out there sleeping, I stayed out there for a long time just watching. And I saw this really big, bright light in the tree line, and then it just started to disappear, and right when it disappeared, I could see the image of a ship. I found that to be absolutely amazing. I saw some meteors and a few satellites, but there were so many things happening in the sky, I can't even count them. And when they would stop and then power, what you call power up, and get really, really bright, you can't explain that.
No.
That is intelligent.
Yeah. Now they do have a satellite called an Iridium Flare, but that's easy to monitor. You can go to heavens above and find out, when those are coming through. And the space station, we know when that's coming through, and Genesis and a few other things, but those are easy to track. And according to the heavens above, they say there's only maybe one to three visible satellites coming over. People don't know the dynamics about satellites and how they only reflect light. And so late at night, you know, when the sun's behind the earth, they're in the earth's shadow, and so they can't actually reflect light. They're not self-illuminated. And so a lot of people don't understand the dynamics about viewing satellites and automatically dismiss everything they see as a satellite. But, you know, when things are flying treetop level or lower, and I mean, I've seen things below the trees, you know, flying through the forest, you know, and things, you know, that are would actually run into the mountain, things going in and out of the mountain. I just can't wrap my head around people saying that these are satellites.
Right. And late at night, I did see a really large light. It got really bright above the tree line, right mm-hmm. at the tree line.
Yeah.
And then as it disappeared, I could see a shadow of a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it just disappeared.
Yeah, it's interesting how that comes down. The, you know, we've had things morph. I actually showed some footage to, I think it was James Todd at OMSI Planetarium. And he's the head guy there, and he's looking at footage of this ship that came down, landed on Mount Adams, started morphing from 1 to 3, back to 1 again, and did it for about probably 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And we filmed this object doing its thing. You know, and his thing was, he said that was the space station.
Hmm.
And
that low?
Yeah, it was on the mountain. It was
on the mountain.
About in the middle of the mountain, morphing from 1 to 3, and he watched the footage. You could see the mountain clearly. You could see where this was on the mountain. And he actually said that, you know, that we're misinterpreting this is nothing more than the space station. And to me, I just, when I hear him say things like that, and these guys are the best of the best, and they make these kind of statements, I have to wonder, are these people like under mind control? They've lost all logic and reason, or is that their job? You know, just to explain everything away, no matter how ridiculous their explanations are. You know, maybe that's their job. That's what they're there to do.
I think they're there to create confusion and doubt, and we just need to trust that that's not true.
Yeah.
We know it. We know it's not true.
Oh, yeah.
We know it. They already exist.
Uh-huh.
And like you mentioned before, contact has already begun. Why do we need a government to tell us that it's already begun?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're coming up at the end of the hour here, so I wanted to give people information on how to contact you or get a hold of your books. And so why don't we go ahead and give that information, and then we'll just go ahead and sign off after we get your contact information.
Okay. You can contact me through Cynthia L. Robbins, Robbins, @gmail.com. Or you can go to my website for the book. It's www.the-light-warrior.com.
So that's the best way to get a hold of the book. It's
on Amazon.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. I haven't read all of it yet, but you know, although it is fiction, you know, there's a lot of truthful information in there, and I think everybody needs to get this and read it and you know, allow it to open them up to a greater reality.
Yeah, that's the hope.
Yeah. Well, anyway, keep up the great work and keep inspiring the youth, and keep them going in the right direction. And hopefully there will be hope for this planet once the youth awaken to a grander reality and maybe their part, you know, in this greater reality.
Let's hope so.
All right, well, thanks again for coming on the show. We've got to sign off. This is James Gilliland signing off. Have a great evening.